Okay, can you guys see my screen? Yeah, okay, good. The joy of Pesach. So, you know, many people, when they get the Mishloach Manos on Purim, they start dividing it into two piles, right? They have the Chametz, and then they have the Kosher Pesach. So anything that's Kosher Pesach that came in on Purim is now off limits. That's going to be all the nosh for the in a month from now. But, you know, in the back of our minds, we hear a Pesach is coming, you know, we're like, oh my goodness. And we think that means, you know, cleaning, and we think about all the preparations, and it's quite extensive. So there's a little nervousness sometimes. Rabbi Drucker pointed out that when he was a Rav, before he moved to Edison, he was a Rav in Detroit. And he said that his neighbor, she herself, was a survivor in Auschwitz. And she remembers as a little girl, she used to say, in Auschwitz, her memories were how she wished she could be home cleaning and preparing for Pesach. Such the Jewish tradition is that that we look forward to these days. And there is a lot of work to be done, but the topic is not about what is chametz and what's not chametz. But I would just say one guiding principle. We're looking for chametz. We're cleaning for chametz. We're not cleaning for dirt. And sometimes, you know, cleaning for Pesach becomes, well, now will be a good time to rearrange all of my sock drawers. That's not what we're doing. And then sometimes we add on unnecessary things, and that creates stress and tension that really undermines the entire purpose of the Yom Tov. Yom Tov is Zman Simchaseinu. It's a time of joy, and we have to connect to that. There is work to be done, but it's done, you know, with a sense of joy and excitement and anticipation for the amazing Yom Tov that we're coming up to. So by reminding ourselves of why we're doing what we're doing makes it a little bit easier. There still is work to be done, obviously, and if any questions come up, if I can be of assistance, I'd be happy to answer them. We could have a separate class on Kitnios if you want, but I want to talk about what makes Pesach such a joyous time. So, by way of introduction, there's a fascinating work that was actually written without his name, it was anonymous, called the Sefer HaChinuch. Now, scholars have been able to do some research and figure out, most probably it was Rabbi Aaron Halevi in Spain in the 1300s, and he had a son who had a little bit too much free time on his hand. So they didn't have screens. They didn't have devices back then. So they had to do something more productive with how to get their children to use their time. So he wrote a Torah book for his son. And the book that the Sefer HaChinuch wrote was, he went through each one of the 613 mitzvos. And for each one of the 613 mitzvos, he does three things. Number one, he'll tell you the pasuk, the verse in the Torah, from where that mitzvah is found. Number two, he tells you the reason behind the mitzvah, why he believes we have certain mitzvahs, why we do tefillin, why we do Shabbos, why there's a prohibition of wearing of shatnez, of wool and linen. He goes through each one of the 613, gives reasons. And the third and final thing he does on every single one of the mitzvahs, he tells you what the halachos are. Does it apply in Israel? Does it apply outside of Israel? Does it only apply in a time when the Beis Hamikdash was standing? Does it apply nowadays as well? Does it apply to men and women? Does it only apply to men? He goes through all of the halachos. So those are the three things. The source, the verse in the Torah, the reason behind it, and the third thing is the halachos. So by way of introduction, it's a pasuk in Parshas Vayikra. If you see the first source here, Kol hamincha asher takrivu lahashem lo saseh chametz. Any offering, a mincha is a flower offering that you're going to bring to God, should not be made out of chametz. That's our big word, chametz, right? Leavened bread. Okay, so that's the pasuk. On this mitzvah of not having anything that is chametz, so comes along the Sefer HaChinuch, and it's fascinating. He gives reasons for all 613 mitzvos. But this is like, again, I'm not an expert in Sefer HaChinuch, but this is like one of the only times, I believe, where he says, I found it very difficult to come up with a reason. What's so hard? Why can't you come up with a good reason for why you can't have chametz? So he writes, that was the pasuk itself, but here's the comment of Sefer HaChinuch himself. He says, the roots of the commandment are very hidden to find even a small hint from them. Meaning like, I got stuck. You know, what are you going to do with this one? However, since I already made known at the opening of my words, my intention with these reasons that I write is to accustom the youth and give them explanations at the beginning of the coming to hear the words of the book. Since the words of the Torah have explanations and benefits, they shall accept them according to their custom and according to the weakness of their intellect, and let the commandments be like worlds of a sealed book at first, lest they rebel against them from this inner youth. Leave them forever, go to emptiness. Hence, I will write everything that comes to my thoughts. And once he knows my intention, don't criticize me on this. So some of the commentators are trying to figure out what's the idea about chametz. Well, we know chametz, leavened, is like it does. It expands. It becomes something that is bigger. Therefore, there's a prohibition of having something that would expand and grow and putting that on the mizbeach. So this idea of chametz represents gaiva. It represents ego. It represents building oneself up, expanding oneself, blowing oneself up, making them bigger than life, not having a healthy sense of humility. So on this, on the blogs from the time of Israel, one of the authors wrote, of the many symbolic meanings of chametz, one of the best known is haughtiness, an inflated ego. Early sources, the Sefer Chinuch, which we just saw, which interestingly is not one of the commandments of Pesach, right? It was just one of the general prohibition of having chametz on a mincha, which is an offering made of flour. Dough raises itself up in the course of leavening. This prohibition, writes the Chinuch, hints at God's contempt for an attitude of self-exaltation. Abstaining from chametz, whether preparing a grain offering or observing Pesach, symbolizes striving for humility. So as we're thinking about this, the deeper meaning of cleaning out and getting rid of and of all the chametz, we do so many things to get rid of the chametz. We sell it. Someone says, I'm going to sell it to the rabbi. And you're not selling chametz to the rabbi. Believe me, the rabbi doesn't want to buy your chametz. What you're doing is you're enabling the rabbi to be your legal agent to sell it on your behalf to a non-Jew. It's quite complicated. It's worth mentioning there was a very well-known, a wonderful man, a Gentile named John Brown, who very recently passed away, and he used to facilitate the sale of most chametz in the New York area, not in professionals, but he was the one who Rabbi Willig would use as his non-Jew to perform the sale with him. I have many fond memories of being in Rabbi Willig's apartment after Pesach was over and watching. And it wasn't a shtick. It wasn't like a joke. Okay, let's just do this. Mr. John Brown was a very wealthy businessman. If he wanted to, he could have continued the sale and purchased all of the chametz and bought it and kept it for himself. And he understood. He had a business sense. I think he was involved in real estate. He knew how finances work and how the real business world operates. And he was an expert in these types of ideas. So it's a real sale. So we sell the chametz, right? We do bittel. We renounce our ownership of it. We do beer. We burn it. We do a bedikas chametz. We do all these things to get rid of chametz. Why? Why are we so strict? So one of the medieval commentators explains, because chametz represents a yetzahara. And that idea of yetzahara, again, as we're seeing here from the Sefer HaChinuch, about people who are trying to exalt themselves and make themselves into a big shot. What really matzah represents, the opposite, is humility. Not being inflated. Simple, poshet, flour and water. No fancy shreds of things, no inflation, just basics. Back to basics. And that's what really Pesach is all about. And that's why it's a time of cheruseinu, as we say in the davening, zman cheruseinu, time of freedom. Because if you're a person who's a baal gaiva, then you're never, a person who has a big ego, you're never really free. You're always, subservient to what other people are thinking about you and trying to inflating yourself, making you big. They tell a story that a person says, he's 20 years old, a young man or woman, 20 years old, walks into a room and says, oh, I wonder what everyone's thinking about me. I wonder what everyone's thinking about me. That's what you think when you're 20. Then you're 40 years old and you walk into the room and say, I don't care what anybody's thinking about me. I don't care at all what anyone's thinking about me. So when you're 40, you don't care. Then you get to be 60 years old and you walk in and you realize people weren't thinking about you at all in the first place. When you're 20, you're so curious about it. When you're 40, you don't care. And then 60, you start to realize. But that healthy dose of humility, people aren't thinking about us. And if they are, who cares? We have to do the right thing. We have to keep a sense of humility in that. So with this idea, let's go one of the famous sources of humility that we have in Pirkei Avos. This is in chapter 4, Mishnah Yud. Rabbi Meir Omer havei mamad ba'esek va'asik b'Torah. A person shouldn't be, spending all the time in business. You should really, our main occupation should be with Torah. And v'havei shofel ruach b'fnei kol adam. A person should be of humble spirit before everyone. So how do you become of humble spirit before everybody? So there's a beautiful story that they tell of one of the great Hasidic rabbis, Reb Shmelk of Nikolsburg. And they were making a tremendous Kabbalah upon him, a tremendous reception to give honor to him when he was coming to visit a particular town. And there was a huge entourage out there, and they had everything set up. It was a big banquet. And the Rebbe Shmelk of Nikolsburg said, before I go out, can I please have a private room to myself. I want to be alone for a few minutes before I go out to the crowds. Okay, so you know, there's always one nudnik, there's always one curious guy, and he puts his ear up close to the door and he wants to hear what's the Rebbe doing in the room by himself. So he listens and he hears the rabbi is in the room by himself, and he's giving himself all sorts of praise. The honorable, the leader of our generation, the great Torah scholar, the righteous, the saintly, the pious Rabbi Reb Shmelk. And he's giving himself honor after honor after honor. And then he comes out of the room. And afterwards, he goes to greet the whole assembly. And this chassid, this student of his, who was, you know, eavesdropping, so to speak, he said, Yilamdeinu Rabbeinu, teach us, why did you do that? Why were you like giving yourself all these titles in like a closed room? So he explained that really, really, I knew that people were going to say these praises about me in a few minutes. And I wanted just to remind myself how foolish it is, how silly it all is. So before they honored me in front of this whole big, congregation of people, a whole big assembly, I wanted to hear myself say those words. I'd realize to myself, it's foolish. It's not real. It's not meaningful. It's not going to go to my head. It's not going to make me an ego. It's not going to make me haughty. It's not going to make me chametz stick. It's going to make me like matzah. So I want to be humble about that. And that's why the Rebbe Shmelk, you know, told himself these things before he went out there. So some of the commentators on this mission, again, the idea being have a shafel ruach b'fnei kol adam, to really be humble before everybody. Well, Rabbeinu Yonah, one of the great medieval commentators, writes, even before lowly and degraded and people who are inferior, meaning we would be humble spirits. You think, okay, of course I'm going to be humble spirit in front of a very righteous individual, a very scholarly individual, very, you know, pious person. Of course, who am I compared to them? Of course I'm going to be humble to them. Comes along Rabbeinu Yonah and says, no. Even in front of a lowlife, even in front of an inferior, degraded, despicable person, you should still be humble before them. And it's not even necessary to say someone who's on the same level as you. I mean, obviously, if someone's great, you have a scholar, you have an amazing person, a spiritual person, of course you're going to be humble from them. But with the Rabbeinu Yonah's adding, you have to be humble in front of people who are on a lower level, or who you think are on a lower level than you. The Rambam, in a similar vein, continues on his commentary on the Mishnah, again, working within the connection, because if you look, it starts off by saying, you should cut down on your business of Asik b'Torah, and then it goes right into the part about being humble. So the Rambam writes, meaning to say, you shouldn't be humble of spirit in front of the big people alone, in front of every person. So when you sit with any man will be, speak with him as if he's greater than you. And this is to flee from pride. So all these things are to help a person have a healthy sense of humility. And again, the idea of pride was chametz. And we saw that was the Sefer HaChinuch says that Hashem doesn't want that. So let me now share with you with the Tanya. The Tanya, which we've quoted many times in our classes, the Tanya was written by the first Lubavitch Rebbe. And this chapter of Tanya actually was not supposed to be, it didn't appear in the original versions. There's a fascinating history of how the development and the different printings and versions of the Sefer HaTanya. Essentially, the Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi, who was the first Chabad rabbi, he gave private, intimate counseling to people who were dealing with spiritual struggles. And his advice, you know, someone once explained, Rabbi Chaim Miller explained it's like a self-help book. The Tanya is a self-help book. And it's helping people deal with real struggles that they're going through. So in the context, a little bit of the background, with a person who's suffering what's called dullness of the heart, timtum halev. We all have periods in life where we're just not feeling it. We're not inspired. We're going through the motions, but you know, really we're just not there. And how do you get through that? So in the previous chapter, in 29, the Tanya had gone through several pieces of advice as to how a person can confront that psychological state of dullness of the heart, timtum halev. And the beginning now in chapter 30, he continues on this theme. But I'm just pointing out, originally this chapter was not actually there. It went from chapter 29 to 31, and then later on, once there was a lot of printing errors and mistakes were coming, so he had to revise the Tanya and send it to a real printing press, not to have it hand-copied because the errors were creeping in, and he inserted this chapter in there. So a little bit of historical background as to what this represents. So says the Tanya, Od zos yasim alibo. Another thing to overcome when you're feeling dull and uninspired, l'kai maimer abosein zichron v'rach, to keep what it says in the pasuk, have a shafel ruach v'fnei kol adam. So a person should try to make themselves, we saw in Pirkei Avos, this is the exact same quote that Tanya's quoting, I can highlight that. This is the exact same D about being humble, humble before everybody. So working on this now, he says, it's not a figurative thing, it means it literally. Literally, there's a way to become humble for every single person. Now, a number of commentators have noted a difficulty in the Mishnah. For the Hebrew languages distinguishes between two types of humility. The first is a feeling of inferiority in comparison to others. The second is the absence of self-glorification even when recognizing that you're superior. Right? The thought that your superior qualities, it's just a God-given gift. And if anybody else would have had the same gifts that I got, they'd do better than me. Meaning, we didn't fill out a little checklist when we were in Shemayim. God, I want to be this smart, and I want to be this funny, and I want to be this creative, I want to be this athletic, I want to be this, you know, emotional. We don't fill out things, Hashem gives it to us. But if anybody else would have been given the exact same talents and kochos and abilities, they would do much more with it. So that's what the idea is, that the Tanya is teaching, this is the way a person can remind themselves that yes, maybe I'm quite accomplished. Maybe in my professional life, in my personal life, I've done amazing things. That's good. But who says that somebody else wouldn't have done better? Maybe if they would have your talents and your capabilities, they would have achieved much more than you have. So that's an idea of how a person can come to being really humble, truly humble in front of everybody. Rabbi Y.Y. Jacobson was relating a story about one of the famous rabbinic leaders in a previous generation. His name was Rabbi Naftali Amsterdam. He wasn't from Amsterdam, but his name was Rabbi Naftali Amsterdam. And he was, whenever he was walking, he was the rabbi of a shul. And whenever he would walk in, he would always have a book. He'd have a sefer with him, whether it was a chumash, or a mishnah, or a gemara, or a navi, whatever it was, he would always walk into the synagogue holding a Torah book with him. And they explained why. Because he didn't want to think that people are actually standing up for himself. So he said, no, they're really giving honor, not to me. They're not giving honor to me, they're giving honor to the book that I'm holding, to the chumash, to this, you know, sefer. And that's the idea that it's not me. Now, we can understand that, but we could ask a question on that. You know, if a regular person would walk in holding a book, they wouldn't stand up for them. So we understood they really were standing up for it. But again, the idea is that one has to constantly remind themselves and work on themselves. And it's not so easy, because our natural tendency is to remind ourselves of how great we are. And we're like that little, what they call the buoy, the thing that floats in the water, right? Every time you try to knock it down, just automatically right size, you know, you can't knock it down, just floats back up. So every time we do something we think is wrong, well, we have a way of self-correcting. We tell ourselves we're perfect. There's nothing wrong with us. But we have to have a little bit of a sense of humility in this and well. You know, there's a story of one of the Hasidim of the Rebbe, the Tzemach Tzedek. His name was Rashbei, it's Reb Shmuel Bezalel. And he heard that there was a secret society of humble people. In this particular town, they had like a secret society of people who were humble. So he says, I have three questions. Number one, how do you have a group? How do you have a society of humble people? It's an oxymoron, right? Like you have to pass a certain test of humility in order to get into the club. So how can you have such a thing like that? And number two, he says, if this is really a secret society, it's so concealed, then how do we hear about it? But the third question that he asked, and perhaps the most powerful, was, what do they have to hide? If you're truly humble, what do you have to hide? Just think about that question for a minute. A really humble person, what in fact do they really have to hide? So when we understand what it means to connect to the Torah, and we're going to see how this all relates back to the Yom Tov of Pesach, is the Torah makes us true, it makes us real, makes us authentic, it makes us connected. And the real thing is that we can truly feel humble, true humility. And as we'll see, when we feel that true humility, when we feel like matzah and not like chametz, that's when the joy can come. When a person can let go of expectations that, oh, the other people think of me, I have other things that people are expecting of me, and a person can move away from that and come to a place of true humility, that's when the joy comes. Let me share with you a little bit more. I'm going to skip a little bit. About Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu in Parshas Bahaloscha, it says, V'ha'ish Moshe anav me'od. The man Moshe was exceedingly humble. Mikol ha'adam, from any other person, asher al pnei ha'adam, whoever was on the face of the earth. So let's think for a second. Who wrote this verse in the Torah? Well, what's that?
Moses.
Moshe. Right, Moses. He wrote about himself how humble he is. So what do you see from that? Anyone want to share thoughts? What do you see from the fact that Moshe writes about himself how humble he is?
That being humble doesn't mean that you're not aware of your strengths. It's what you do with it.
That's right. That's right. Being true humility doesn't mean that I think I'm a nobody, I'm a loser. It means I understand I have talents and I have abilities, but that my perspective, and to constantly remind myself, it's all a gift. One of the greatest anovim, humble people of our generation was the great Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Coincidence, the same name. Rabbi Moshe was the leader of American Jewry, an address which everyone turned to answer the most complex questions in Jewish law. And at a certain point in time, there was a discussion about whether Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was going to have a pacemaker inserted into his heart. And he spent a lot of time researching the inyan, the topic. And they asked him, Rosh Hashiva, why are you so curious to find out all the, you know, the facts about, you know, what's your you know, preoccupation with this? So he explained that having this operation with a pacemaker might turn him into a status of a person who's a balmum, someone who is called blemished. And what it really means is that if he was a balmum, if he was quote-unquote blemished by having this operation, he would not be allowed to sit on the Sanhedrin, the court of the 71 greatest rabbis of the generation. So he was doing extensive research to find out if he had this operation by having the pacemaker inserted, would it disqualify him really from being able to sit on the Sanhedrin of 71 judges when the Mashiach comes. So you see from this story an amazing thing. Rabbi Moshe knew who he was. He knew exactly, like what you said, he knew his talents. He knew that he was one of the top 71 rabbis in the generation. And he knew full well that if Mashiach would come, he would be asked to sit on the Sanhedrin. So he wanted to make sure that this was not going to disqualify him for a technical reason, because he had this operation, this procedure done to him. So a person can recognize their talents and still remain humble. You know, just we're telling stories about emotion. There's a beautiful story that, it's not beautiful what happened to him, but the midos, his character traits. One time there was somebody who was escorting him to a car, and they helped him in the car and they closed the door. And then the car drove down the block and turned the corner. After the car had driven down the block and turned the corner, Rabbi Moshe asked the driver to please stop, to pull over to the side and stop the car for a minute. So the driver, of course, listened. And what happened was Rabbi Moshe opened up the car door and it had been closed. The door, I shudder saying it, it closed on his hand. The door closed on his hand in the door. So then they asked the driver, why didn't you say something right away? Now, he held the pain in and didn't say anything because he didn't want to embarrass the young man who had helped him to put him in the car, that he realized that this man accidentally closed the door on his hand. So he suffered. He waited till the car drove down the block and then turned the corner so he wouldn't see what had happened. So this is just a small idea of the humility of the tzidkus of one of our gedolim. Now, Pesach is the time for cultivating humility. Here's an article from OU, from Adina Sokloff. I'm sure that many are in the thick of getting ready for Pesach. I don't know, that's why I probably had, it's good to have the shiur earlier. This is a plug for next week's shiur. We're having a shiur also for questions and answers, Q&A's on Pesach. But we're not in the thick of getting ready, we're in the thin. We're starting. We saw the 7-layer cake, it looked good. We're in the thin of getting ready for the Pesach. We associate Pesach with the eating of matzah. However, it's more than a commemorative food. It's also called the bread of humility. What she's quoting is for a passage in the Zohar, that we define the matzah, it's called the bread of faith, it's called the bread of healing, and in certain contexts, it's called the bread of humility. So again, not inflated, not chametz, down to earth, being real. On Pesach, we remove all the leavened bread, the chametz from our homes, and eat only matzah to symbolize the removal of arrogance and egotism. We're supposed to embrace the midah, character trait of humbleness. Humility does not seem to be in vogue these days, but it's an important character trait to have. It's a necessary ingredient in developing a healthy self-concept, and most important, critical to a person's self-esteem. True humility stems from appreciating yourself and understanding your strengths well, so much so that you don't need to rely upon others to determine your self-worth. Our Jewish tradition emphasizes, Reb Simcha Bunim of Peshischa teaches that everyone should have two pockets, each one containing a slip of paper. On one should be written, I am but dust and ashes, Anochi Ofer Ve'efer. And the other, the world was created for me, Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam. From time to time, we must reach into one pocket or the other. The secret of living comes from knowing when to reach into each. When's the time to remind ourselves of our humility, and when's the time to have a build ourselves up with a holy self-esteem? What does this mean? We all need to know, our children included, that the world was created specifically for us, and we are infinite value because we're created by God. However, He created you because He has a job for you to do in this world. Your worth is tied up into how much you contribute to society. We must use our talents and discover our purpose. We can't live only for ourselves. If we don't temper our self-knowledge and self-worth with humility, then we're like dust and ashes. Our reverence of cultivating our child's self-esteem without the tempering their ego is hurting our children. How can we help our children develop self-worth? How can we help them find their purpose so they can contribute to the world at large? How can we teach them humility, the humility they need in order to have true self-esteem? So she has six ways. I'll do one of them. I pick number four. To teach humbleness. According to allprodad.com, humility should be taught explicitly, just like any other thing we want our children to learn. When your child wins the prize for his science fair and it's the night before his reward ceremony, review with him what he should say. Look, that's a great job you did on your science fair project. You worked hard on it. When you accept the reward, it's best if you say something like, thanks, I like the way my friend Matt did his project too. I don't think I could have won without the help of my teacher. We should model humble behavior for our children. It's contagious. Children pick up on that. They see us. When we think they're not looking, they're certainly looking. When we think they're not listening, they're certainly listening. The kids have these hypocrisy meters. It's crazy. You know, you teach high school kids, these teenagers, they can smell hypocrisy 2 miles away. When the kids are watching us, they understand if we teach them and model for them how to speak in a humble, polite, respectful way to everybody, then they'll pick that up as well. Help children find their purpose. Most people need time to find their purpose. Usually it's tied up with what we love to do. We could start by supporting our children in their dreams. Even if your dreams were unrealistic as a child, I want to be the next LeBron James, I want to own a horse, I want to be a fireman, there's a kernel of truth in them. These are important clues for your child, so don't squelch your child's dreams. Listen to them, dream with them, and more important, attach a higher purpose to that dream. And just one more. Let kids hear you attribute purpose to your work. Very recently, I was listening to a session of question and answers by Aaron Lopiansky. He's a Rosh Hashiva in Greater Washington. And he was talking to young men in Eretz Yisrael, in an American yeshiva, and he's saying, you know, someone asked me, one of my students asked me the following question, talking about like what's meaningful in picking a career. And he said, Rebbe, my job is to make rich people even richer. Is there any purpose to that? Is there any meaningful in helping people who are extremely wealthy already just make more money? That's what he's asking. He goes, am I doing something that's purposeful with my life? Like, I don't know what he answered him, but the question you can hear. So, children do what we do, not what we say. If they hear us attributing purpose to our work or to any of our activities, it'll be more natural to them. What we can say when they're in earshot, the best thing about being a doctor is being able to help people get well. I love what I do. I love teaching families better ways to get along. I hope this cake that I'm baking for the Schwartz family cheers them up. It's hard when the mom of the family breaks her arm. So all these are examples of types of statements we can make that help increase the humility. And that's where the simcha comes. Once we're able to do this, obviously there's a lot of work, as we began by talking about doing the physical cleaning out of the chametz and preparing the homes. But even more important is the spiritual work that we do during this time period. The spiritual avodah of cleaning out the chametz, not only that's just the cupboards in my kitchen, the cupboards in my heart. To clean all the chametz in the eye and the ego and the haughtiness that I have. And if I find a little chametz, gotta get rid of it. If I find myself, I look down, I think condescending thoughts towards others, or I speak about others, this is the time when cleaning for Purim is to prepare it, to get rid of all of those things. I just want to end off with one last source for tonight. How the ego conflicts with true joy. That this idea about being humble, which is what Pesach is all about the matzah, and becoming happiness. That's what we said, the joy of Pesach. So, going to come back to something we quoted a few minutes ago. We said, what's written about Moshe, the man Moses was very humble, more than any on the face of the earth. Moses knew his greatness, that he was on a higher level than any other person. Nevertheless, he remained the most humble of men. He was able to do this because he felt that all that was given to him above. After all, when he was born, his mother saw that he was good. So Moses reckoned that if such abilities were given to someone else, that person would also be on such a level, perhaps higher, since he may bring out these abilities even more. This type of humility is a channel for joy. This is where the simcha comes from. For as soon as you begin to feel your own existence, you've lost the opportunity for true joy. That sense of feeling oneself is primordial snake. That's the nachash that was in Gan Eden. It's well known the snake by nature is always depressed. Superficially, it seemed quite the contrary, that a person who feels himself very strongly should also feel the good he's received much more. If so, he should be happier than someone who doesn't feel himself so much. But no, his happiness is never complete for two reasons. Firstly, because he believes the world owes it to him. It's coming to me. Magia li, es kommt mir. What's to celebrate? A person's especially happy when he receives a gift, but for this person, there's no gifts, because you're just getting what you deserve. It's not you got to be something extra. You know, people get depressed when their expectations aren't met. For example, a person walks into the room, and they imagine, when I walk in the room wearing this outfit, 10 people are going to turn and look at me and give me a compliment. So my expectation, when I walk in the room, 10 people are going to compliment and tell me how nice of an outfit this is. And then you know what happened? Only one person did. So my expectation was 10, and the reality was 1. So I'm so upset because 90% of my expectations were not met. But if a person says, you know what? I'm going to walk into a room, and maybe one person will say, hello. And when my expectations are so much lower, and one person does say, hi, nice to see you, you look good. Wow, all of my expectations were met. I'm feeling great. I didn't think 10 people, I thought 1. Because it's not like I was entitled to it. People have a sense of entitlement. First of all, they're miserable to be around because they always feel like, you know, more and more, you know, whatever you do is not good enough for them. But a person should have to let go of that sense of entitlement to what I have. And when that happens, that's when true humility can come in. A person can feel like a true anav, can feel humility. That's when the joy comes. It's not a contradiction. In fact, it's the recipe. The way that a person can feel true simcha, true joy in their life, this Pesach and all year round, is by making themselves humble. Okay, secondly, because a person feels himself so strongly, nothing is ever enough. You know, the Gemara says, a person who has 100 wants 200, right? If you have 200, you want 400. I have a friend I grew up with in my neighborhood. His father was a very, very wealthy man. I mean, I'm telling you, as a kid, it was like so cool because like the cars, they had the Lamborghini and the Ferrari and the Porsche and like Mercedes. Every car that you wanted, this kid had. And his father was not a happy person because his father, it doesn't matter necessarily what business he was in, but he was always in competition. And I used to hear him talking about, oh, my friend just got a helicopter. Now I have to get a helicopter. And like, it was like, it sounds like a joke, but like, these are like the things I remember as a little kid hearing this person talk that way. Whatever you think, oh, if I only had fill in the blank, then I'd be happy. No, because as soon as you get fill in the blank, you don't want 2 fill in the blanks. And then you want 4 fill in the blanks. You want 8 fill in the blanks. Person has to be mistayumu. You have to be besimcha with what you have. If so, a person's never able to fully rejoice. In truth, within whatever happens, he does achieve is buried a certain sadness, since he remains essentially dissatisfied. How much more so when he's not getting what he feels he deserves, he's truly depressed. The joy of a humble person, of Pesach, on the other hand, is complete. He's perpetually celebrating. After all, since he doesn't feel himself so keenly, he doesn't consider himself so important, he feels he doesn't really deserve anything. So for him, what he gets is, it's a gift. Matnas chinam, a gift for free. And so causes great celebration. And if the influx of life is sometimes lacking, that doesn't sadden him either, since he doesn't feel he deserves anything, so why should he be depressed? Besides, he's hardly an entity in his eyes, he lacks nothing. Whatever happens is justified. For that reason, he's never depressed. And the contrary, he rejoices when he's lacking as well. Humility and a sense of nothingness are the receiving channel and the cause for happiness. That's the takeaway from tonight. Humility and a sense of nothingness. Again, not that I am a nobody, but a sense of bittul, as it turns out, are the receiving channel and the cause for happiness. So, as we prepare and we're getting ready for this wonderful, amazing Yom Tov of Pesach, we can have joy in the fact that we realize that we're getting rid of the chametz. We're improving ourselves. And, you know, some people, they got all the checklists. They have all the Pesach lists. They got all the looks. They got the thickest book of all the chumras, all the stringencies. But they missed the main point. The main point is this should be a time of simcha and a time of true freedom. And the way that we achieve our true freedom and our simcha on the Yom Tov is by making ourselves into humble people who can appreciate and recognize the blessings that Hashem gives us each and every single day.